Good morning and welcome to the Monday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan and these are the top stories of the day. John Oliver returns to the UK for a look at the general election on Last Week Tonight by Melissa Locker. John Oliver returned to the United Kingdom, the country that has been saying yes, Queen, for centuries, on Sunday for a look at the recent general election. Despite the fact that elections weren't due for 3 years, Prime Minister Theresa May called the early or snap election in a bid to consolidate her power. But it failed, resulting in what Oliver called a crumpet f**k of epic proportions. May is now holding on to power by a thread, according to Oliver, despite running against characters including Elmo and a man known as Lord Buckethead, who ran on a platform of the abolition of the lords, except me, and looked like Darth Vader f***ed an Amazon Echo. To help his American audience understand the implications of the election, Oliver compared England's upcoming exit from the European Union in terms of Florida leaving the United States. A great idea, and we should definitely do it, but it wouldn't be easy. Think about everything that would actually entail, said Oliver. Florida shares a border with Alabama that would potentially need patrolling. Any goods going over that border, like oranges or meth, would likely be subject to tariffs. He also noted that someone would need to take custody of Hulk Hogan. Oliver then looked at whether the UK will have a hard Brexit or a soft Brexit, which should not be compared to hard or soft cheese or a color scheme, according to Oliver. He noted that the single most honest statement from any candidate in this election regarding the difficulty of the task ahead came from a man with a 2-foot bucket on his head. Here are the best and worst moments from the 2017 Tony Awards. By Jennifer Kalfas. Move over, Hamilton. The tear-jerking Dear Evan Hansen dominated the 71st Annual Tony Awards on Sunday night, scooping up 6 awards, including Best Musical, Best Score, and Best Actor. The modern musical that explores depression, loneliness, and teen suicide edged out its top competitor, Come From Away, a Canadian musical about a Newfoundland town's effort to help diverted travelers on September 11, 2001. Come From Away still left with the title for Best Director of a Musical. The Bette Midler-led Hello, Dolly! Won Best Revival of a Musical, Oslo won Best Play, and Jitney won Best Play Revival. The most nominated show this year, Natasha, Pierre, and The Great Comet of 1812, won 2 creative awards. Kevin Spacey hosted the show, which was held in Radio City Music Hall in New York City and included a slew of appearances from celebrities in and out of the Broadway world, like Stephen Colbert, Tina Fey, Lin-Manuel Miranda, and Whoopi Goldberg. A Tony winner himself, Spacey held his own in the theater world and delivered an opening number that channeled each of the nominees for Best Musical. And while the number of political jokes were less frequent than those seen in other award shows, nominees and winners voiced their support for funding for the arts in schools and around the country as potential cuts face the National Endowment for the Arts. Here are the best and worst moments from the show. The best. Ben Platt. At just 23 years old, Ben Platt won Best Actor in a Musical for his emotional performance of the titular character in Dear Evan Hansen. Platt stunned while leading his cast in a performance of Waving Through a Window before accepting his Tony. Platt's mannerisms during his acceptance speech, of course, mirrored those seen in the character he plays 8 times a week, a lot of tears, and an ability to talk really, really quickly. But perhaps his most memorable message came at the end of his speech, when he highlighted a key theme from the musical, "You will be found." Don't waste any time being anyone but yourself, because the things that make you strange are the things that make you powerful, he said. Kevin Spacey's impressions. Spacey was not the first pick to host the award show. Singing and dancing isn't his best-known method of acting, and he made many self-deprecating jokes in his opening performance to make that clear. But Spacey threw in some remarkable impressions throughout the night, taking the stage as Johnny Carson and Bill Clinton. He made one of the only few political jokes throughout the night as Clinton, speaking to Dear Evan Hansen's Platt, who in the musical creates a fake email account, "Now, between you and me, you might be a better singer, but after seeing your show, there's no doubt that Hillary is much better at creating fake email accounts than you." While Spacey had many good moments, his role as host likely won't top performances from past hosts like James Corden or Neil Patrick Harris. Benj Pasek and Justin Paul. These two have had quite a year. The songwriting duo won Best Score for Dear Evan Hansen just months after winning an Academy Award for Best Original Song for La La Land. Rebecca Teichman. One of the few women who's won for Best Direction of a Play, Rebecca Teichman took home the Tony for her work on Indecent, a play that retells the history of a controversial Yiddish play. "I hope this amazing thing that just happened helps encourage women all over, of every color and taste and style and viewpoint, to make theater to tell stories that matter to them," Teichman told the media of her win. Alex Lacamoire. While his speech wasn't televised, Alex Lacamoire won Best Orchestrations for the second year in a row, having a hand in both of the most recent Tony-dominating musicals, Dear Evan Hansen and Hamilton. He also won his first Tony in 2008 for the same category for In the Heights. Cynthia Erivo and Leslie Odom Jr. The two 2016 Tony Awards winners returned for a stunning performance of New York, New York with the Radio City Rockettes. In 2016, Odom won Best Actor in a Musical for his complex portrayal of Aaron Burr in Hamilton, and Erivo won Best Actress in a Musical for her groundbreaking performance as Celie Harris in The Color Purple. Falsettos Reunion. The star-studded cast of the revival of Falsettos reunited in a performance at the Tonys this year, where it was announced a taped version of the musical will hit movie theaters around the country this summer. Led by Christian Borle, who won for Best Featured Actor in a Musical, and Andrew Rennells, the cast performed the upbeat A Day in Falsetto Land. Great Comet Performance. While the most nominated musical missed out on all of the top awards for the night, the cast of Natasha, Pierre, and the Great Comet of 1812 left its mark with a vibrant performance led by its star, Josh Groban. The Worst. Bette Midler's absence from Hello, Dolly! Performance. Due to some behind-the-scenes drama, the iconic star did not represent Hello, Dolly! In its Tony's performance. David Hyde Pierce instead performed Penny in a Pocket from the musical's revival. Midler's absence came as a result of a disagreement between the producers of the Tonys and Hello, Dolly! Producer Scott Rudin offered Midler's performance on the condition that it would be done at the Schubert Theater, where it's performed. But the Tonys producers declined, Playbill reported. As expected, Midler won Best Actress in a Musical and outlasted the orchestra trying to play her off during her acceptance speech. "Shut that crap off," she yelled. Very predictable. Predictability with the Hamilton-dominated 2016 awards wasn't surprising, but with a slew of competition this year, it would have been nice to see some surprise wins for musicals. Though Dear Evan Hansen lost Best Director to Come From Away, it beat its fiercest competitor in every other top category. Even in the highly competitive Best Actress in a Musical field this year, the expected winner, Bette Midler, beat out performances from legends Patti LuPone and Christine Ebersole. Weak jokes. While Spacey did a decent job in his role as host, a few jokes fell flat. In his opening number, Billy Crystal offered some advice to the nervous host to wear a dress if all else fails. Spacey then immediately donned a dress and turban, a la Glenn Close's Norma Desmond in Sunset Boulevard. "I'm coming out, Spacey belts. No, wait." Especially during Pride Month, it's unclear if jokes about coming out and cross-dressing were warranted. The new Kingdom Hearts 3 trailer promises dazzling battles and titanic enemies by Matt Peckham. It's been forever and a day since there was a Kingdom Hearts 3 sighting, much less a surprise and surprisingly meaty gameplay trailer dropped unexpectedly during a Kingdom Hearts Orchestra World Tour concert in Los Angeles. The third installment in Square Enix's action-packed franchise mashup of Disney's most beloved characters and its own Final Fantasy icons has been missing in action for more than a year, until now. The new Japanese-language trailer Halo drops series protagonist Sora into the midst of a squadron of armored Heartless, the series' central enemies, where he proceeds to make short work of the lot, employing stylish spin leaps, hovering flip strikes, and magical powers that leave devastation in their wake. Don't blink or you'll miss the combo with Goofy, who first boosts Sora high into the air and then is hurled like a bomb back to the ground, raising a mob. The trailer takes place on Mount Olympus, where Sora, Donald Duck, and Goofy are helping Hercules battle as Disney villains like Maleficent and Pete banter about an enigmatic hidden item. The teaser continues with glimpses of new areas, a gargantuan boss fight, and hints of other gameplay goodies to come. The trailer then becomes a trailer for a trailer, asking viewers to tune into D23 Expo 2017 on July 15th, at which point Square Enix says it will present a new world and new trailer for the game. D23 has been the official Disney fan club since 2009, the 23 referring to 1923, the year Disney was founded. The D23 Expo is a biennial conference held in Anaheim, California, and once in Japan, that celebrates all things Mouse House, including properties like Marvel, Pixar, Star Wars, and more. That, conversely, means this is probably the last we'll see of the game until D23. It's also interesting to observe a company like Square Enix opting out of the traditional E3 conference onslaught, especially during the annual game show's first stab at opening its doors to the public. Kingdom Hearts is certainly popular enough to generate scads of solo buzz, once more raising the question of whether these games benefit or suffer from being shoehorned into multi-hour conferences loaded with content like informational fire hoses. Why Friends May Be More Important Than Family, by Amanda McMillan. Friends become increasingly important to health and happiness as people age, according to new research in the journal Personal Relationships. They're so crucial, in fact, that having supportive friendships in old age was found to be a stronger predictor of well-being than having strong family connections. The new paper explores the findings of two studies about relationships. In the first, involving more than 270,000 people in nearly 100 countries, author William Chopic found that both family and friend relationships were associated with better health and happiness overall. But at advanced ages, the link remained only for people who reported strong friendships. I went into the research sort of agnostic to the role of friendship, says Chopic, assistant professor of psychology at Michigan State University. But the really surprising thing was that in a lot of ways, relationships with friends had a similar effect as those with family, and in others they surpassed them. For the other study, Chopic analyzed a separate survey of nearly 7,500 older people in the United States. Here, he found that it wasn't just important to have friends, but that the quality of those friendships also mattered. When people said that their friends were a source of strain, they reported having more chronic illnesses. Interestingly, that was not the case for people who reported strain from their spouses and children. When their friends were a source of support, people were happier. None of this is particularly surprising, says Chopic. After all, unlike our family, we can choose our friends. A few studies show that we often enjoy our time with friends more than with family, he says. We do leisurely things with friends, whereas family events are often serious or maybe a little monotonous. The benefits of having close pals may also be stronger for older people because by that point, those friendships have stood the test of time. You've kept those people around because they've made you happy or at least contributed to your well-being in some way, says Chopic. Across our lives, we let the more superficial friendships fade and we're left with the really influential ones. But Chopic says the power of friendship on physical and mental health is often ignored in research, especially in older people, where relationships with spouses and children are often considered more important. And while it's true that family members are often the people who provide caregiving support to the elderly, he says this can also create a sense of obligation. These relationships are certainly beneficial and often vital, Chopic adds, but they may not provide as much joy as those with longtime friends. Of course, some people can share powerful friendships with their siblings, spouses, children, and other family members, and that's a positive too, says Chopic. The general point is that the more support, the more positive interactions, the better, he says. The important thing is having people you can rely on for the good times as well as the bad. The man who invented Hawaiian pizza has died, by Mahita Gajanan. The man who invented Hawaiian pizza, setting off one of the biggest debates in food, died on Thursday at the age of 83. Sam Panopoulos, who was born in Greece and moved to Canada when he was 20, decided to try out pineapple on pizza in 1962 to attract customers to one of his Ontario-based restaurants. "We just put it on just for the fun of it, see how it was going to taste," Panopoulos told BBC earlier this year. "We were young in the business and we were doing a lot of experiments." Panopoulos said he and his brothers enjoyed the contrast between the pineapple's sweetness and the savory flavor of the ham also added to the pizza. They named it Hawaiian Pizza after the brand of canned pineapple used on the pie. Adding pineapple on pizza became a heated topic earlier this year after the president of Iceland jokingly denounced the topping, sparking backlash online, a trove of memes, and even prompting Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to weigh in. "I have a pineapple, I have a pizza, and I stand behind this delicious southwestern Ontario creation," he tweeted in February. An obituary for Panopoulos described the Hawaiian pizza inventor as an unforgettable personality and commended him for his loyalty, protective nature, and sense of humor. You asked, what's the best way to lose 5 pounds fast? By Markham Hyde. You've heard, over and over again, that gradual weight loss is sustainable weight loss, and you're totally going to incorporate all of those healthy lifestyle changes that will help you shed your extra pounds and keep them off for good. But you'll start all that next month. This month, you've got your friend's wedding and a beach weekend to worry about. So, what's the best way to lose 5 pounds fast? Start by ditching salt, says Dana Hunnis, a senior clinical dietitian at UCLA Medical Center. The average American eats about 4,000 milligrams of sodium a day, and that can cause you to retain a lot of water weight, she explains. Just cutting your sodium way down can help you lose 3, 4, 5 pounds very quickly. To do that, you'll want to avoid all packaged products, including cured or deli meats, all of which tend to be loaded with salt. Hunnis says anything under 1,500 milligrams a day is really good, but if you can go lower, sticking with fresh foods, even better. Also on the chopping block, processed carbohydrates. Think breads, pastas, fruit juices, and pretty much all snack or dessert foods. Carbs are hydrophilic molecules, meaning they love water, Hunnis says. They make it more difficult for your body to release water from your kidneys through metabolism. By ditching both processed carbs and cutting way back on sodium, you'll lose weight, and it will be the kind around your midsection that people will really be able to notice. With water weight, you can be bloated and not realize it, Hunnis says. I have people do this and say, "I can see my abs for the first time." Two important warnings here. If you're not completely healthy, talk to your doctor before making any changes to your diet, Hunnis says. Also, if you're exercising a lot while you're trying to lose weight, especially if you sweat a ton when you work out, you need to be careful about slashing salt too severely. Sodium is one of the electrolytes your body loses when you sweat. If you're adding an intense exercise program to your low-salt diet in order to lose weight, you could be at risk for hyponatremia, a potentially life-threatening condition linked with heavy sweating, heavy water intake, and too little sodium consumption. The risk for hyponatremia is very low, but it's something to be aware of if you're really pushing yourself hard by exercising for hours a day while drinking a lot of water and consuming little salt, Hannes says. What if you're already disciplined when it comes to salt and processed carbs? You can lose 5 pounds in 2 weeks by restricting your diet to one meal and three protein powder shakes a day, says Dr. Xiaoping Li, director for the Center for Human Nutrition at UCLA's School of Medicine. Your one meal should be non-starchy vegetables, so no beans or potatoes or rice, and lean protein like chicken, fish, or eggs, Li says. You also want to cook your vegetables and make them the dominant part of your meal. Cooking veggies helps your body absorb more of their nutrients, and the protein in your meat and shakes will help keep your hunger in check. Your lone meal should include about 3 cups of food, and it doesn't matter if you have it at lunch or dinner, she says. When it comes to protein shakes, the type of protein, whey or plant-based, doesn't matter much either. It's the amount that counts. Women should have 1 scoop or 20 grams of protein with each shake, Li says. Men should aim for 30 grams. Mix that protein powder with water or almond milk, but skip dairy milk. While dairy fat can help you lose weight, it's not ideal if your goal is short-term, rapid weight loss. You can have black coffee or water, Li adds, but skip the cappuccinos or alcohol, which tend to pack a lot of calories per ounce. When next month finally rolls around and you decide to reach a healthy weight for good, doctors have advice about how to do that, too. Theresa May reshuffles cabinet amid calls for her to step down. By Jill Lawless for the Associated Press in London. Embattled British Prime Minister Theresa May appointed ministers to her shaky government Sunday as some Conservative colleagues rallied to support her, and others said her days were numbered after last week's disastrous election. May is seeking a deal with a Northern Irish party to prop up the Conservative minority government, and lawmakers said the rebuff from voters meant the government would have to abandon planned policies and rethink its strategy for European Union exit talks. A stream of senior lawmakers entered her office at 10 Downing Street on Sunday afternoon to learn what roles they had been given in government. May's weakened position in the party rules out big changes to the cabinet lineup. Downing Street has already said that the most senior ministers, including Treasury Chief Philip Hammond, Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson, and Home Secretary Amber Rudd, will keep their jobs. As rumors swirled about plots to oust May, Johnson denied he was planning a leadership challenge. He tweeted that an article in the Mail on Sunday headlined "Boris set to launch bid to be PM as May clings on" was tripe. "I am backing Theresa May. Let's get on with the job," he said. The Conservatives lost their parliamentary majority in Thursday's election, a vote May called in a bid to strengthen her mandate ahead of exit talks with the EU. Instead, she has left Britain's government ranks in disarray days before the divorce negotiations are due to start on June 19th. May's party won 318 seats, 12 fewer than it had before the snap election, and 8 short of the 326 needed for an outright majority. Labour surpassed expectations by winning 262. Former Treasury Chief George Osborne, who was fired by May last year, called May a dead woman walking. And opposition leader Jeremy Corbyn said he was ready to contest another election at any time. Many senior Conservatives say May should stay for now to provide stability, but few believe she can hang on for more than a few months. "I think her position is in the long term untenable," Conservative lawmaker Anna Sobry told Sky News. But Graham Brady, who chairs the influential 1922 committee of backbench Conservative lawmakers, said a self-indulgent party leadership campaign would only cause more uncertainty. He acknowledged that the government would be unable to get many of the measures promised in its election platform through Parliament. May called the election to win explicit backing for her stance on Brexit, which involves leaving the EU's single market and imposing restrictions on immigration while trying to negotiate a free trade deal with the bloc. Some say her failure means the government must now take a more flexible approach to the divorce, potentially softening the exit terms. Scottish Conservative leader Ruth Davidson, who took the party from one Scottish seat to 13, said there would now have to be consensus within the country about what it means and what we seek to achieve as we leave. To stay in power, the Conservatives are seeking support from Northern Ireland's Democratic Unionist Party. May's office said Saturday principles of an agreement had been reached, but the two sides later clarified that they are still talking. "We have made good progress, but the discussions continue," DUP leader Arlene Foster said. Downing Street said it hopes to finalize the deal next week after Parliament resumes sitting. The two sides are looking to form a confidence and supply arrangement. That means the DUP would back the government on confidence motions and budget votes, but it's not a coalition government or a broader pact. The alliance makes some modernizing conservatives uneasy. The DUP is a socially conservative group that opposes abortion and same-sex marriage and had links to a Protestant paramilitary group during Ireland's sectarian troubles. Conservative lawmaker Nicky Morgan told ITV that she could support a confidence and supply arrangement with the DUP, but any closer deal would be a step too far. A deal between the government and the DUP could also unsettle the precarious balance between Northern Ireland's British Loyalist and Irish Nationalist parties, whose power-sharing administration in Belfast collapsed earlier this year. Irish Prime Minister Enda Kenny tweeted Sunday that he had spoken with May and indicated, "My concern that nothing should happen to put the Good Friday Agreement at risk." The 1998 Good Friday Agreement set up power sharing in Northern Ireland, largely ending years of sectarian violence. The British government doesn't have long to ink a deal. It is due to present its platform for the next session in the Queen's speech at the state opening of Parliament on June 19th. The speech will be followed by several days of debate and a vote. By tradition, defeat on a Queen's speech vote topples the government. Corbyn said Labour would try to amend the Queen's speech to include its own commitments to end austerity and boost public spending. Without the amendments, he said Labour would try to vote down the speech. "I don't think Theresa May and this government have any credibility," Corbyn told the Sunday Mirror, predicting that there could be another election within months. "I can still be Prime Minister," Corbyn said. "This is still on." Why Sleeping In May Be Dangerous, by Amanda McMillan for Real Simple. Social jet lag, the term for what happens to your body when you stay up late and sleep in on the weekends, may contribute to poor health, worse mood, and fatigue, even if you still get the quote-unquote right amount of sleep every night. A preliminary new study found that every hour sleep was shifted per week was associated with an 11% increased risk of heart disease. The new findings were presented recently at the annual meeting of the Associated Professional Sleep Societies, LLC, a joint venture between the American Academy of Sleep Medicine and the Sleep Research Society. The full study has not yet been published in a peer-reviewed medical journal. But the authors say their findings seem to indicate the importance of sleep regularity on overall health. To study the effect of altered weekend sleep patterns, researchers looked at survey responses from approximately 1,000 adults ages 22 to 60. To determine participants' average amount of social jet lag, they subtracted weekday from weekend sleep midpoints. If a person reported sleeping from 11 to 7 on weeknights, midpoint 3 a.m., and from 1 a.m. to 9 a.m. on weekends, midpoint 5 a.m., for example, that's a two-hour difference. After adjusting for other factors that could affect results, such as income, education, employment, total sleep duration, and insomnia, the researchers found that every hour of social jet lag was independently associated with a 22% increased likelihood of self-reported good health, as opposed to excellent health, and a 28% increased likelihood of fair or poor health. Each hour of weekend sleep shifting was also associated with an 11% increased risk of heart disease, as well as higher scores on fatigue, sleepiness, and depression. Because jet lag, the real kind and the social kind, affects circadian rhythms, the researchers hypothesize that out-of-whack hormone levels could be to blame for these effects. Because the study was observational, it cannot determine a cause-and-effect relationship between social jet lag and health outcomes. But it does suggest that getting the right amount of sleep on the weekends is not all that matters, says lead author Sierra Forbush, a research assistant at the University of Arizona. This suggests that a regular sleep schedule may be an effective, relatively simple, and inexpensive preventative treatment for heart disease as well as many other health problems, Forbush says. And it's definitely something to take seriously, she adds, since cardiovascular disease is the number one killer in the United States. The American Academy of Sleep Medicine recommends that adults should sleep 7 hours or more per night to promote optimal health, and sleep experts often say that keeping a consistent bedtime, yes, even on Fridays and Saturdays, is one of the most important aspects of good sleep hygiene. If you stay up late and sleep in once in a while, it's probably not a big deal, says Forbush. But if you're doing it every single weekend for 15 years, then it probably is. More research is needed, she adds, to determine how chronic social jet lag over time might affect health, since the study only looked at responses from one point in time. The take-home message, says Forbush, is that sleep consistency should be a lifestyle goal. Just like we should be getting 30 minutes of exercise a day, she says, we should also be working toward keeping our sleep regular on the weekdays and the weekends. This article originally appeared on RealSimple.com. 1 year after Pulse. Following the deadliest mass shooting in U.S. history, one young victim tries to heal from her physical scars and the loss of a childhood friend. By Charlotte Alter. Almost exactly a year ago, Kalisha Andino and her childhood friend Luis Omar Ocasio-Capo went out on the town. Omar had recently moved to Orlando from Nashville and was working as a Starbucks barista as he pursued his dream of becoming a dancer. Andino, who goes by Cali, first met Omar in middle school in Cleveland, Ohio. He always wanted the people around him to be happy, she says. He always said to live life to the fullest. That night out was June 12, 2016, the same night Omar Mateen entered Pulse nightclub with a handgun and semi-automatic rifle and began firing, killing 49 people and injuring 53 in what became the deadliest mass shooting in U.S. history. Kelly, who was visiting the club for the first time, was shot in her back and her arm. Omar, just 20, became one of the youngest people killed. This past year has been the hardest year of my life, Kelly says. After 3 different surgeries and physical therapy 3 times a week, she can finally move her fingers and pick up small objects again. She says she has about half the strength she had before the shooting. The healing process has been hard, Callie says. It's like you're starting all over again. Over the course of the last year, Callie met Preston Ganaway, a photographer who has been documenting the stories of queer youth across the country, including those recovering from the Pulse attack. For a lot of us in the broader LGBT community, it did feel really personal, says Ganaway of the shooting. I wanted to tell a story that showed a little bit more of the long-term effects that this was having. Despite her difficult recovery, Callie hasn't lost sight of her plans. I'm still going to college, and one day I want to own my own business, she says. What happened to me is not going to stop me from becoming somebody in this world. But even as she looks forward to her own future, she mourns the dreams that Omar lost. He wanted to become a dancer and an actor, she says. He was only 20. He had a bright future ahead. Senator Lindsey Graham, President Trump could go down for discussing Russia investigation. By Mahita Gajanan. South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham said on Sunday that President Trump's inappropriate discussion of the investigation into his campaign's potential collusion with Russia was frustrating. Here's what's so frustrating for Republicans like me. You may be the first president in history to go down because you can't stop inappropriately talking about an investigation that, if you were just quiet, would clear you, Graham said on CBS's Face the Nation. Graham said that while he did not believe Trump was under investigation or had obstructed justice, the ongoing drama in the administration could prove harmful for the president. Graham's comments follow Trump's Sunday morning tweet that former FBI Director James Comey was cowardly for leaking one of his memos to the press shortly after he was fired. Can you be a street fighter on all things all the time and still be president of the United States? Graham asked. Saving $1 million for retirement is possible even if you start at age 50, by Jennifer Kalfas. It's wise to start saving for retirement as soon as you get your first job, but for those who delayed or were unable to do that, all hope is not lost. Even starting at age 50, it is possible to save more than $1 million for retirement, according to research released in May by the American Association of Individual Investors, the AAII. Or, looking at it another way, even for those who have paltry savings by the time their 50th birthday rolls around, adding $1 million to their nest egg from that point forward is attainable. Many 401k participants save less than the 15% of pay that is often recommended, data from Vanguard and Fidelity show. The AAII shows five different scenarios of how much people can accumulate by saving from age 50 to age 70. You make the maximum 401k contribution, including the catch-up contribution allowed for those 50 or older, a total of $24,000 a year. You make the full $18,000 a year 401k contribution, but skip the catch-up provision. You save $1,000 a month, setting aside $12,000 a year. You contribute the maximum to an IRA, including a catch-up contribution, $6,500 a year. You make the maximum $5,500 IRA contribution, but skip the catch-up provision. In each case, Charles Rotblut, a vice president at AAII and editor of the AAII Journal, assumed that you would earn 8% a year from a stock and bond portfolio. The 401k and IRA contribution limits are based on the rules for 2017. The projected account balance at 70 years old ranges from $1.3 million for a person who maxes out his or her 401k, including catch-up contributions, to $300,000 for a person who saves only to the basic $5,500 annual IRA limit. Of course, for people who have been half-hearted savers, putting aside as much as $24,000 a year, even with a substantial paycheck, won't be easy. Meeting that goal will likely involve changing saving and spending habits, cutting habitual and often mindless day-to-day spending, like going to Starbucks for a $4 cup of coffee is a start, but for people who don't have a history of saving, it may also require far bigger changes, like downsizing housing costs or taking a second job. Some diligent savers take similar moves in order to afford early retirement. People need to look for ways to both save and consider what they can do to boost their income, whether it's getting a promotion where they're at, changing jobs, or in some aspects, considering having a part-time job in addition to their full-time one, Rotblut says. A recent study found that more Americans than ever believe they will need at least $1 million for a comfortable retirement. But dwelling on that target number will make the task more daunting, Rotblut said. Worrying about the big number they're going to reach, it's going to seem almost unattainable, he said. Instead, people should focus on finding ways to save money because they'll realize they'll make far more progress than what they think will be possible. Former Twitter CEO compares meeting with President Trump to waterboarding, by Eric Jenkins. Former Twitter CEO Dick Costolo said that attending President Donald Trump's meetings with Silicon Valley leaders is like waterboarding yourself. If you don't get invited to this meeting and you want to know what it was like, just drink a bottle of gin and then waterboard yourself, Costolo tweeted Friday. The former Twitter chief, who ran the company from 2010 to 2015, was referencing news of Trump's impending meeting with entrepreneurs and venture capitalists in the tech space later this month, according to BuzzFeed. Silicon Valley leaders have had a complicated relationship with the president since he was elected in November. A number of powerful industry leaders, including Apple's Tim Cook, Facebook's Sheryl Sandberg, and Tesla's Elon Musk, met with Trump in December to smooth tensions following disagreements throughout his campaign. Musk and Uber CEO Travis Kalanick also participated in White House advisory councils. The latter came under fire amid company scandals to the point of his resignation due to pressure from Uber employees and outside groups. The Tesla chief, meanwhile, opted to stay on until Trump vowed to withdraw the U.S. from the Paris Climate Agreement at the beginning of June. Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.